and click with a shock. From the Jenga domain knock under the bat. Something's coming from the box.
From the beginning of motion picture history, Hollywood has tried to show you what the afterlife is really like.
Good afternoon and welcome to Judgment City.
Do you have any idea what's going on?
No.
Well, in a nutshell, you're here to defend your life, and I'm going to help you.
Defend my life?
Finally.
Wow.
The first true story of what happens after you die.
Where am I? Is this heaven?
No, it isn't heaven.
Is it hell?
Actually, there is no hell. Although I hear Los Angeles is getting pretty close.
Didn't anyone ever tell you carry yourself very stiffly?
Leave me alone, I'm dead.
That's life.
Albert Brooks.
You make me think of my little poodle.
It may seem.
Meryl Streep.
I think I might have been a heavyset man at one time.
Rick Torn. Lee Grant. Buck Henry. In a new film by Albert Brooks.
So I'm on trial for being afraid.
Well, first of all, I don't like to call it a trial. Second of all, yes.
If you see one movie before you die...
I love you!
I love you!
This is damn exciting stuff.
See, defending your life.
Most people love it. Some it makes nauseous. Don't worry about it.
Written and directed by and starring Albert Brooks, Defending Your Life introduces us to Daniel Miller on his birthday. We instantly see that he's a bit of a sad sack. He gets a CD player from his coworkers, but complains he doesn't make enough money. He picks up his brand new Mercedes-Benz, but is disappointed when the dealer accidentally shows him a bigger and better model first. While listening to Barbara Streisand's Something's Coming, Daniel takes his eye off the road and is promptly hit by a bus. We next see Daniel as he enters the afterlife, and this is all before the opening credits. After a confusing first 24 hours, Daniel learns that he is not in heaven and that there is no hell, although his main contact, played by Rip Torn, tells him Los Angeles is getting pretty close. He is currently visiting a sort of midpoint in the afterlife, where his life will be examined by a tribunal to see if Daniel should move forward into the universe or be sent back to Earth to work on the basic fears that have kept him from actualizing his true potential. This is complicated by the fact that Daniel meets a woman, Julia, a luminous Meryl Streep, whom he immediately bonds with. Julia has led a courageous, generous life, so it's clear she will not be returning to Earth. Will Daniel be joining her, or will his life of fear, worry, and bad decisions hold him back? That is the eternal struggle of Albert Brooks' Defending Your Life. As anybody knows who's been listening to the show regularly, I am a mega Albert Brooks fan. As a filmmaker, I have seen every one of his movies, except for maybe Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, dozens and dozens of times, some probably maybe even more than that. I've listened to his comedy albums a lot. I just absolutely love this guy, and Defending Your Life is one of his great films. So, Max, I need to ask you, are you a particular Albert Brooks fan, or is it just specifically this movie that you wanted to talk about?
Hey, it is Albert Brooks, and it's something he is sort of, for me at least, a prototype of a certain type of comedian who is very kind of common now. But you know, he was just this he's got this kind of hangdog, tired of sense of being, and it comes through in his delivery. He's constantly flustered, and who he reminds me of a lot is Larry David.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I think there's a direct parallel there. And to me, where Larry David has this kind of like rage bubbling under, Albert Brooks is just so resigned, and that really comes through in this movie in Defending Your Life, because I'll tell you what the line is when we get to it. But he's just so put upon, but he's also just really, really funny. And yes, that's been true across all of his movies and, his, as you mentioned, his stand-up and all that. He's just, he is a comedian who is true to himself, and it works.
I absolutely agree with all of that. Yeah, I connect to him. I mean, a lot of people have called Albert Brooks, you know, the California Woody Allen. And there are some comparisons there. And then Woody Allen is certainly deserving of the plaudits that he has gotten over the years. I think it's a little bit of, that's not fair to Albert Brooks, as if, you know, he has no sort of persona on his own. And he does. He has a very particular, I mean, he is beset at all sides by reality. I mean, the first scene, as I mentioned, you know, he's in his office, or he's in an office, and he's talking to his coworkers, and, you know, he talks about how it's his birthday, and his mother called him, and his mother said, you know, are you still making that same amount of money? You know, and it's like that kind of thing. It's like right off the bat, you know, and then he mentions to his employer that he's hoping he can double his money in 5 years, and the boss is like, good luck, and he goes, 10 years? Well, maybe, okay. And then he says, I'd like to all combine you into one pretty woman. Cause he's dangled by himself. And even like when he gets into a friend's car, and the friend is taking him to get the Mercedes, and the friend is driving a Jeep, you know, and he's like, why do you drive this car? And he's like, I like it. And he's like, well, this isn't a car. This is a battering ram. Is there a flood coming that I don't know about? I mean, it's like he worries about every single thing. And again, he goes and gets the Mercedes, and the Mercedes dealer is like, you look like you've lost a lot of weight. And he's like, how could I have lost a lot of weight? You just saw me 2 days ago. And he's like, I think you're 20 grand lighter. That's it. That's the look, you know? It's just like, there's always these little, and you know, I have to say, I relate to that.
Well, you know, that's a good point. And the thing is Albert Brooks, and especially in this movie, but just in general, his whole thing is that, you know, life is a series of tiny disasters. And they just pile on and pile on, and they're just, it's life. It's just things that everyone has to go through. And, you know, you mentioned Woody Allen, and I mentioned Larry David. And I think the difference is that Albert Brooks is very, very relatable. And he is likable, where maybe, yes, Larry David is and is. And, yes, you know, and I have trouble relating to Woody Allen on a certain level. But Albert Brooks is like, oh, my God, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. And you root for him. You root for Albert Brooks.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I'd say in this movie, almost more than any of the others. I mean, he did Real Life in 1979, which is a parody of documentaries. Like, sort of, he was really ahead of the game. I mean, it's a reality TV movie, way before that was a thing. And he plays himself in that movie, and he's really unlikable in that film. He plays such a son of a bitch. And the fact that he wrote the movie himself tells you a lot about his self-actualization of how he thinks of himself. And then there's Modern Romance, which I think is still an undiscovered masterpiece. And then Lost in America, who is a guy who really sets himself up for failure. But I mean, here he's killed by that bus because his CDs slide off the seat and he just loses track of where he is in traffic. And so, I mean, you know, when he's put on trial, I love his lawyer, Rip Torn, right, who is great in this movie. Rip Torn is fantastic. I mean, he's just so Bob Diamond. But I love when he's like, you know, so I'm being put on trial for being afraid. Don't think of it as a trial. Second of all, yes. That kind of stuff. Right. And like, you get all these – the way the trial is set up is that we get flashbacks into the life of the person on trial. So it's – you know, you see – it's, you know, it's every moment of your life is being recorded by this sort of structure that has been put in place. And so we see Daniel Miller as a child, as an infant, as a child, you know, as he goes through life. And there's a prosecuting attorney played by Faye Grant. And the whole idea is Faye Grant is saying that Daniel Miller is so controlled by fear, as are most people on earth, that they just haven't been able to push through that. And therefore, they don't want that level of sort of paranoid fear being moved into the universe. And so if you have, and there's this whole setup with when he talks to Rip Torn about, you know, how many times have you been sent back? And Rip Torn is like, oh, I went back, you know, 9 times. How many have you gone back? And he's like, 70. You know, and Daniel Miller's like, 70 times. I'm the dunce of the universe.
You know, that's one of the things that I find really interesting about this movie, because the plot itself is very simple. You know, like you said, he's basically on trial, even though they say don't call it a trial, that he's on trial for how he has lived his life and whether or not he advances, in a sense. But throughout the movie, they drop little hints at the mechanics of the universe.
Yeah.
and how things work. And basically it's like this giant karmic wheel where there isn't really a heaven, but there's, you become a higher being in a sense.
Yes.
And there's no hell. You just go back to Earth, you know, which some might, you know, as he says, you know, about LA, but, you know, and in a larger sense, they make the point that there is no good or bad, you know, and that's kind of what you're getting at there. It's, they're judging people based on fear and based and how they have approached their life. And the greatest thing that they can achieve is higher intelligence, you know, because they're always talking about how much of your brain are you using.
Right. Yeah.
And I think Rip Torn is using 41%, and another prosecutor is using 54%, and Albert Brooks says, "Whoa, well, how much am I using?" He says, 3%.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, right from there, you could see for all intents and purposes, for, you know, us, would be a heaven, because it's, I think there's little bits in the movie that you have to pay attention to that are great. Like he's looking at the Weather Channel. And it's just a constant crawl that says 74 degrees and perfectly clear all the time.
You know? Sounds like heaven to me.
Yeah. And so the weather is perfect. You can eat as much as you want and never get sick and never feel, you know,
and it's
full.
The best food anyone's ever had. It's the best. Right. It's the most delicious food you've ever tasted.
Oh, God. And every time Albert Brooks eats anything, it's orgasmic. He's like, this is...
And it comes up in 2 seconds. He goes to the diner and he orders the eggs and sausage. And he gets it in 15 seconds. And he's like, was this made for somebody else? Like, no, it's made for you. And he digs in and he's like, And he's like, this is the best eggs I've ever had. They're like, yeah, go ahead. Eat all you want.
Yeah, eat all you want. But almost from the beginning, he's already picking at it. He's already finding fault with it, you know, and he's finding things to be worried about, to be fearful of, which is kind of the point of the movie. And the opposite of that is Meryl Streep.
Julia,
who just embraces everything. You know, she's constantly eating
right.
throughout the movie, and it's everything. It's 3 pounds of pasta and corn dogs and, you know, all this stuff. And that dynamic is kind of what sets the tone for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, he can't escape who he is. I mean, he's going to be sort of fearful and whatever. And, I mean, even critical, there's a great scene where him and Julia go to, like, a stand-up comedian. and the guy's awful because he's doing jokes about being dead. And there's the great bit where he's like, you know, he's trying to get the audience to participate. And, of course, most of the people in the afterlife are old.
Right.
Daniel Miller and Julia stand out as that they're young. She died by tripping over the chaise lounge
and falling
into the pool. And as she says, that's ironic because I was a good swimmer. And but the great thing with the comedian is, like, you know, he's like, he's talking to the guy, you'd like the horseback ride? And the old guy's like, no. And the guy's just left with nothing. And he goes, how long have you been dead? He goes, I'm not really. How'd you die, Art? Coma. Long coma? I really don't know. And he says, let me play a little game. Elvis, living or dead? Living. Long coma, Art. Long coma. And there's this great reference where the comedian reaches out to Albert Brooks' character and Daniel Miller, and he says, how did you die? And he says, on stage, like you, which gets a huge round of laughter, and that's what brings Julia over. And, of course, in real life, Albert Brooks' father was a comedian who died on stage.
Really?
Yes. He was one of those old-timey comedians, and he did a bit, like at a Friar's Roast, he finished his bit and died on stage.
Wow.
So that's right out of Albert Brooks' life. By the way, Albert Brooks' real name, do you know what Albert Brooks' real name
is? No.
Albert Einstein.
You're kidding.
Their family name is Einstein.
Wow.
They named him Albert. Talk about setting him up for failure. But yeah, I mean, Meryl Streep is... I mentioned earlier, she is luminous in this movie. She is just so beautiful. I mean, she's naturally a beautiful woman and her fierce intelligence. But she looks almost like overjoyed to be doing a kind of simpler movie. I mean, she did such heavy material her whole life. Sophie's Choice and Out of Africa and Ironweed and all of these heavy Oscar movies. She looks really delighted to be in this comedy. And she's very funny. She and Brooks have a great chemistry. They
really do.
You know, you could see them. It's so hard in movies when the main two characters have to fall in love so quickly, but you sort of buy it. They go miniature golfing, and she has this great laugh, a very infectious laugh. And as you mentioned, she's eating the corn dogs, and he can't adjust to the idea that you can still eat
Right. Everything
you want. He's still worried about it, and she's just chowing down. She just buys it entirely. And you do see glimpses of her quote-unquote trial where – her house burns down and she runs in to rescue a cat, because she's not afraid of anything. She's
after saving her children. Yeah.
After saving her children, she has two adopted children. And they get into the whole bit about, that they fiddle with your brain a little, mm-hmm. that you aren't upset that you've left your loved ones behind.
Right.
You're bothered on some level, but you know, it's going to be okay.
Right.
And that's how that allows you to focus on your trial and whatever. And yeah, poor Jenny. And you mentioned a whole bit about your brain. They talk about there's one day in the trial where Bob Diamond is gone. He just isn't there anymore, and he's replaced by Buck Henry, who talks about that he uses like 67% of his brain.
Right.
And Faye Grant is like, "Is that clocked?" And he's like, "Clocked." this whole thing.
And then he doesn't do anything during the day of the trial.
He says nothing. He lets all the evidence just go by, and he goes, I'm good.
I feel very good about this.
I feel very good about this. Albert Brooks is like, "You're kidding." He's so besieged. This, one of the things I love about Albert Brooks is that you talk about, yeah, he is such a sad sack, but he – and I find this is something I love about 30 Rock – do you ever watch 30 Rock? Did you watch that show?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of the debates that they had about 30 Rock was, a lot of people seem to suggest that show was siding with the Alec Baldwin character, that it was saying he was right. And I don't agree with that at all. I think what the show was doing was saying the world sides with the Alec Baldwin character, but that's, forgive my language, fucked up.
Yeah.
The world would be better if it was more like Liz Lemon, but the world doesn't. And I think that was the difference. And I think that's Albert Brooks' comic persona, is that he himself is saying the world does not agree with the way I look at things, but it should.
Right.
And I think that's why Albert Brooks has that sort of angry energy where he just can't believe the world is so stupid. And even in the afterlife, the world is – and there's a point where he watches this game show where they talk about past lives, and it's like a talk show, and the woman's like, "I slept with Ben Franklin." And then, and like, "What was he like?" "He was fat, Bob." Like, it was just like – it's this cheesy, terrible programming even though it's in heaven. I mean, it just – and, of all of his – I think all of Albert Brooks' movies are pretty deep. They don't look it. They're all about 90 minutes. They're short. They get in and out. But this one really has a lot to chew on sort of emotionally. And I can't be the only one that, when watching this movie, thought about, how would you suffer, Max? If you went to this life, how much of fear would you have to deal with? I know I'd be sent back, unfortunately.
Well, and I think that's the thing. I think – like I was saying about everyone can relate to Albert Brooks. And I think that's the thing, is that 2 days into it, Albert Brooks is already acting like, "That's it. I'm getting sent back." and I think watching the movie, I felt the same way. I was like, "Oh, there's no way. There's no way. Because he's not a bad person. And he's not necessarily any more fearful than the average, person I would know.
Right.
And I think you kind of feel that frustration that you would have with yourself, of saying, why can't I be the person running into a burning building to save a cat? Mm-hmm. I'm the person who couldn't stand up to my boss in that moment. And I think we all are more like Albert Brooks than Meryl Streep in this movie.
Oh yeah. There's a whole long bit about where he rehearses how much money he wants to make from the new job. And he's like, and he rehearses with his wife or his girlfriend.
His wife.
Or his wife, okay. And he's like, "I cannot work at this place for any less than $65,000.
Right.
And his wife's like, "47. Let me make this perfectly clear. 65. 49? 65. And then they cut to the job interview, and he's like, "I'll offer you 40 grand. I'll take it."
I'll take it.
He folds immediately.
Well, and that's kind of reflected in the movie too, because at some point, after he meets Meryl Streep, and I want to point out too that they're only there for a few days. He's
Right.
I think he's there for 9 days. They say his trial is going to take 9 days.
They show 9 days, I think. I think everybody's trials are 4 days, but they how many days you are looking at is what the difference is. Julia's right. are like 3 days. Like Julia's they're just shooting her right through the system. I mean, even her prosecuting attorney is like a fan of hers.
Well, at that one point, he goes to look at her screening, and they're just fawning over her. And we'll be back. We'll meet tomorrow, but that's just going to be for fun.
When she grabs the cat, what kind of cat is it? Siamese? Oh, I love Siamese.
I love Siamese, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, at some point, Albert Brooks notices that Julia is in a much nicer hotel.
Right, yeah. He says, come over to my hotel, we'll paint it.
Right. You know, she's getting chocolates and everything. I think he gets a mint on the pill. You know, and so he's already, even in the afterlife.
There's a pecking order.
There's right? a pecking order, yeah. Right. And he's very aware of it.
When he's in her hotel, and there's you hear the voiceover about caviar is now being solved in the Roosevelt, served in the Roosevelt room. And he just kind of shrugs his hand. He's like, oh, of course.
And, you know, but it's the concept, so many of the concepts are great. And like you said, he doesn't hit you over the head with it, but they're there. You know, at the very beginning, they're saying, you know, everyone, there's an announcement over the PA and it's saying everyone here should be from the Western United States.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So we've made it so it's recognizable and comfortable for you. And it basically looks like an idealized Los Angeles. And, you know, there aren't any cars. There's a trolley system, you know, and you probably know about the trolley system in L.A.
Right.
You know, back in the, what was that, the 40s?
Yeah.
That, you know, was killed by the auto industry, supposedly. You know, but, you know, here it's all trams. It's clean, you know, the sky is blue.
Everybody's in these white robes.
Everyone's in those white robes.
Tupas, they call them.
Yeah. And Bob Diamond makes a point of saying, you look good in yours. You make that work.
Yeah.
But you know, in spite of that, like he just keeps picking at it and picking at it, picking at it. And then that ends up kind of being his downfall.
Yeah, I mean, he can't relax. I mean, when he goes to the restaurant with Julia, and Julia, as you mentioned, is getting 3 pounds of pasta. And, you know, and, like, there's a point where the maitre d' is like, I like you. I'm going to bring you some steaks. And he brings him, like, 20 steaks. And Daniel's like...
Well, and that was after he brought him 9 pies.
9 pies. I'm going to bring you 1 pie for every day you're busy. You're going to do 9 pies. And he's like, stop it. You're embarrassing me. And the guy's like, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, and so, yeah, he can't adjust to this idea, which, you know, it's hard. Obviously, you're in the afterlife. I mean, you know, but he can't – yes, the fears that he has. I mean, there's this great – it's a little kind of an offhanded line, but I found it quite resonant where Bob Diamond says, do you have friends whose stomachs hurt? Yeah. And Daniel says, all the time. And he says, that's fear. That's fear nodding away at you, you know. And it's – I mean, the movie cheats a little in that, you know – fear in some cases is a good thing. I mean, if you didn't have fear, you'd walk out into traffic or, you know, whatever, or do other horrible things that I could mention. But, you know, but they do get into some cases where, you know, yeah, he takes less than what he wants, mm-hmm. you know. And there is that great moment with Buck Henry where he says, you know, why did you fold so quickly? And he says, because that man had a suit. And that suit smelled like $40,000. And Buck Henry's like, I like that very much. And he was just like, what? You know? But, you know, and then
I do think they address what you're talking about. And then again, it's another throwaway line. You really have to pay attention to Albert Brooks' movies when you're watching them.
Oh, yeah.
There's a line. I never remember what they're talking about. Oh, it's after – because they're watching, you know, one of his scenes from his past – from his life. And it was after he has a snowmobile accident.
Oh, right. He crashes the snowmobile. Right.
Yeah. Right. And he breaks his leg and he has to crawl 3 miles. And the prosecutor argues that that's not courage, that it was self-preservation.
Right.
And so it's this, you know, it's especially with Albert Brooks, he gets this across so well. It seems to be about the fear that we put into ourselves more than any kind of fear of anything that's actually happening.
Yes. Yeah. It's the self-imposed, I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to look stupid or I'm going to, I mean, yeah, there's nothing wrong with fear of traffic or fear of, you know, being whatever. But, I mean, there's the scene about which Bob Diamond uses as a positive where he just has gotten divorced and he is going to take a trip to Asia. And the woman at the desk says, you're in seat B.
Right.
And he says, I'm seat B. I'm sitting between people all the way to Asia or China or wherever, or Japan, right, or wherever he's going. And she's like, yes. And he's like, is coach full? And she's like, yes, I'm sorry, it is. And he's like, is first class open? Yes, we have one seat left. How much is that? That'll be an additional tick, 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 $7,000. And there's this long hold on, yeah, Albert Brooks. And he finally says, I'll take it. And it's like, that's that little moment of making, you know, making yourself feel better, even though at that moment he had just gotten a divorce and he was broke.
Right.
He realized, you know, we'll get the money, as Bob Diamond says, he'll get the money back. You know, it's that little moment. And I, you know, again, I reflect on my life of like, what are the things I have done where I've pushed through the fear? And I think about how much fear has held me back to doing the things I've wanted to do. I worry very much about what people think of me, and I sometimes, mm-hmm, I twist myself into knots over it. And then I think about all the times where I've pushed through that fear, and what's happened. Well, I would argue probably 9 times out of 10, it worked out pretty well. And, right, the 10th time that it didn't work, but it wasn't like, oh God, why did I even try? It was like, all right, nothing, you know, all right, right, it didn't work, but no big deal. And that's, I think that's an important thing to think about. It's something to reflect on of like, you know, what are the things that are holding you back? What are the things, you know, that are keeping you? And again, the movie fakes it a little for the sake of a gag. I mean, there's one point where his prosecutor decides to show a compilation reel of him just being stupid, right, and it's him falling, and you know, and you're like, well, that's not him being fearful or whatever, that kind of thing. And there's a scene where he refuses to invest in Timex watches, or not Timex, in
Casio.
Casio. And she says that's a negative, and you know, he's like, well, I thought it was a bad investment. That's a little unfair, because you're like, well,
right,
that wasn't him being fearful out of fear. He was, because, you know, he was trying to invest and he didn't think it was a good investment. But for the most part, the movie has a really interesting philosophical argument. And we just covered a movie on the show a couple of weeks ago called A Matter of Life and Death, which is about people in the afterlife. There's a Japanese film called Afterlife, which I saw many years ago, about sort of this processing center where you get interviewed about your life and whether you move on or not. And this movie, you know, talks about that, about, you know, we want the universe. Bob Diamond says, the universe is a big machine, right, and we don't want a bad part to get through. And so we only want people to go through to move on to the next life who are, you know, better people, not better, you know, in the sort of bad sense, but just more evolved, smarter, kinder. And he said, clearly Julia is. There's the whole thing about using your brain, about where you can manipulate your taste buds.
Right.
And, you know, you see the stuff that Bob Diamond eats, and it looks like horse crap, basically. Right. And Daniel says, let me try it. And he eats it, and he's like, oh, and he almost chokes because it's so horrible. And Bob Diamond says, it tastes a little like horse shit, doesn't it? And he's like, this is what smart people eat? And he's like, you'll realize when you can manipulate your taste buds like I can, this tastes very different to me than it does to you. And meanwhile, poor Albert Brooks is like, blah, 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 you know, it's horrible. There's a wonderful scene where they go to the Past Lives Pavilion, where you can see your past lives. And, you know, I don't know how much I believe in reincarnation. I feel like reincarnation is probably the theory of the afterlife that makes the most sense, mm-hmm, to me. I don't know how much I believe it, but, you know, I also can't explain why I love the 30s and the 40s so much.
There's, sure,
you know, and so I think maybe that's what it is. But anyway, you see a line of people, and there's this great moment where there's an old guy, and he sees one of his past lives, and he's like a little girl with ringtails, and he's like, hello, Mumsy. And the guy's like, what the hell is this? Like, he cannot deal with it. You see that Julia was like Joan of Arc. Or no, yeah. Prince Valiant.
It's Valiant.
She's like, come on, man, let's lead the charge. And then you see Albert Brooks, and Albert Brooks is like an African
tribesman
yeah. And he's just running from an elephant or something.
You can hear an animal growling.
You can hear the animal growling, yeah. And he's like, who are you? She's like, I'm Prince Valiant. Where are you? And he's like, dinner. And of course, the Past Lives Pavilion is introduced to everybody by Shirley MacLaine.
Right.
In a wonderful cameo. I love when you first see her, you hear someone just off screen go, oh my God.
Well, and then it goes back to them and it pans and everyone's mouth is hanging open.
Yeah. That's a wonderful sequence. It's such a great gag. And the idea of the fact that the afterlife is run like, you know, like you said, like it's run like California. It's run like a big shopping center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's places for you to see. There's miniature golf courses. There's all these just activities to keep you entertained while you go to your trial. And then there's the great scene where Daniel goes to the sushi place and he meets the guy. And the guy's like, I'm looking at 15 days. Is that a lot? And they're like, I don't know. And you find out all he did was sell porn. He came up with the phrase all nude girls. That was his contribution to society.
Yeah, no, and they're all, drink more sake.
Yeah, 9 days. 9 days. Oh, you better have more sake. 9 days. There's, like I said, and this is, we're making it sound very sort of serious, but it's just very, very funny. And it's always hard to describe comedies on this podcast because either you find something funny or you don't. Mm-hmm. But I just find Albert Brooks, just his so sort of skewed look at something. There's the flashback to when he was a kid and his best friend, they're in art class, right. And his best friend, like, didn't bring his...
He lost his art supplies.
So little Daniel gives him his as kind of a nice gesture, and Daniel gets punished for it, and they use that as an example of, oh, look, he wasn't fearful, you know? And then they cut to, later with his own dad, and he completely folds and sells out his best friend. And Faye Grant's, the lawyer, says, did you not realize that your best friend got suspended or got expelled for that? And he has this line, I thought he left on his own. That line makes me laugh so hard. I don't know why. The idea that you would think a small child leaves school of his own volition.
It's got all these kind of heady philosophical things going on, but it's a very light movie in just in watching it, and you know, to go back to Meryl Streep, where you're in the Past Lives Pavilion, when she sees that she's this heroic knight, you know, on horseback, she is just laughing out loud with how delighted she is at that image, and she's kind of like that through the whole movie. I don't know looking into this movie, I found a Rolling Stone interview with Albert Brooks this is apparently the 25th anniversary. This year is the 25th anniversary of Defending Your Life, and
you're right, 1991. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and they did an interview with him, and he said that he had met Meryl Streep at a party, at one of those Hollywood parties.
Wow.
And that, you know, it was sort of the same thing that you expect Meryl Streep to be, you know, Oscar winning Meryl Streep,
right?
And but that at this party she's just delightful and funny and interested in people and warm. And he said, and they had talked about the movie because he was just getting around to working on it. And she had said, you know, is there a part for me? Kind of joking.
Wow.
And he said, and I, that made me realize I wanted to get her in the movie, but I didn't want Meryl Streep, the actress. I wanted Meryl Streep, the person I met at this party.
Huh.
And that's kind of how she comes across. You know, she's very, in a lot of weird ways, this is one of my favorite Meryl Streep performances.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Just because of how personable she is, how much you can connect with her, you know, and
you want to be around her. She's got an attraction, and it's not necessarily, I mean, in a sexual sense, although she is beautiful, but it's like, this is someone who you would have wanted to hang out with in life.
She is the kind of person that not only do you want to hang out with in life, she is the kind of person that you want to be more like.
Yes.
You know, and but in all the good ways, not in an envious way. You just admire this kind of person, and it makes you feel better to be around that kind of person.
Yeah.
And it really comes across in this movie.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, yeah, Brooks as a director has a really light touch. I mean, he deals with pretty heavy things in a lot of his movies, but he's a solid director. And so the movie, you know, after the trials are over, or they're winding up, Julia, and by the way, anybody listening to this, we're going to spoil the ending of this movie. I don't think it matters, but because you should see it anyway if you haven't seen it, but we are going to spoil it. So if you don't want to hear spoilers, don't proceed at this point. But anyway, Daniel and Julia have one more date, and it ends at her hotel, and she offers Daniel to come and stay the night. And he wants to, in the worst way, But he won't, because, as he puts it, and this is, he almost says this word and then he stops himself. He's afraid, and he doesn't say afraid. He goes, I don't want to. And then he says he doesn't want to be judged. He just feels as though, you know, he's been waiting his whole life for a perfect love, and he's found it in, as I think they put it in the way station. I forget the phrase he uses.
Yeah.
But the pit stop. That's the pit stop. And he's like, you know, thanks God or whatever. And they're like, yeah. And so even though it really breaks Julia's heart, he refuses to stay with her. Mm-hmm. And they part, and it's really sad. It's really, you so want to reach into the screen and be like, just do it. Just,
right.
Come on, Daniel, just, you know, but he doesn't want to, he's had this, you know, perfect 3-day relationship, and he doesn't want it to end badly. So they,
I think he says he doesn't, that if it's good, then and then they have to split, that he's going to regret it forever.
Right. Right.
Or that if it's bad, he's going to regret that too, because he will have ruined something perfect. And he, like you said, he keeps saying, I'm tired of being judged.
Yeah.
I'm tired of being judged.
Yeah. I mean, he can't ever look at things. There's never any upside really to any of this stuff. So they separate, and then he decides he feels bad about it, and he leaves a message for Julia at her hotel, which is sort of funny because there's two Julias at the hotel that he calls right. And he leaves a message for both, you know, and he's like, I'll love you forever and I'll miss you forever. And then he goes for his final trial, his final day of the trial. He is they sentence him to go back. And there's a really nice little moment where Bob Diamond gets the verdict in very fast, and he tries to sort of BS Daniel a little, and he's like, so how do you like our city? And Daniel's like, what does it say? And he's like, you're going back. And you really feel sadness, like yeah. real sadness, because you just like you feel so bad for Daniel. And at the end of the movie, you see that they're all headed to different trams. One set of trams are going back to Earth. Another set of trams are going somewhere else. And as the trams start to take off, Daniel sees Julia on another tram. And he can't believe it, you know, and he starts pounding the glass to be with her. And she's calling to him. And he, despite being told to sit down, I mean, what? Finally, here you go. He's being told, sit down, don't unbuckle your seatbelt. He breaks out of the door. He runs across this gangplank with all of these trams flying at him in all different directions. He almost gets hit. He jumps onto Julia's tram. He can't break in.
And he's getting shocked by some sort of energy.
Right. There's like an electrical – they mention. You hear on – there's like a voiceover where you hear, you know, please be careful. The trams have an electrical field when they're in motion. And he's getting zapped and zapped, but he won't. Doesn't matter. And they're separated by this pane of glass. And he's like, I love you. I won't let you go. I won't let you go. Mm-hmm. And then they pan back, and you see that the very people that judged him were watching this. And Bob Diamond says something to the – and I'm getting like a little caught up saying – recurring this. And he says, brave enough for you? And Faye Grant looks all musty-eyed. And then you see the judges kind of mutter. And you hear the one say, let him go. And the tram opens. He comes in and hugs Julia, and everybody claps, and the music swells, and you find out that Daniel and Julia are going to go off to the next level of existence together. And that is the end of the movie, and in an unusually happy ending for an Albert Brooks movie.
And it is very touching. I will, you know, my wife and I rewatched it this morning, actually, just before this recording. And, you know, we both teared up a little bit. You know, and I've seen this movie a bunch of times.
It's a beautiful ending.
Yeah.
I mean, Albert Brooks, I this is something that I've said on Bob Dylan about, where, you know, Bob Dylan is so famous for sort of being negative and down, that when Bob Dylan is positive, I think it carries more punch, because this is someone who is not just a smile button. You know, he's not just always trying to make you happy. So when he actually is happy or upbeat, I think it carries more weight. And Albert Brooks is like that. Albert Brooks' first three films are pretty downer. And then this one is much more upbeat, and maybe that's – he was in a better place in his life. His next film, Mother, was similar to this, much more upbeat. So I think maybe he's kind of mellowed in his age. But the movie has a good old-fashioned sort of happy ending. But to me, you buy it. It seems plausible. That they were giving Daniel this one last chance to, you know, to be brave, to breathe, mm-hmm. to do the thing. This is what he wanted more than anything else, is to be with Julia and to hell with the consequences, maybe literally. And he does it. He does the thing. And so him and Julia head off, and that's the end of your movie. And it's just, I think, Defending Your Life, just in the total, is just a wonderful, great comedy with a lot to think about, but also really, really funny. And that's hard to do.
It really is, and I completely agree. I think if I were to recommend a movie to someone who had never seen an Albert Brooks movie, this would probably be the one I would start them with.
Oh yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's a lot of fun. You get a real sense of Albert Brooks's style of humor.
Yep.
And it has some serious themes and some big ideas, but it's also very easy to digest, I guess. It's easy for us little brains to understand. As they say, we only use 3% of our brains, but
some of us less than that.
And I think this is a movie that everyone can enjoy and get something out of. And you know, if you like Albert Brooks's humor, this is definitely a way into his other movies that might be a little harder to swallow down.
Yeah, for some strange reason, this is the only Albert Brooks movie not on Netflix at the moment. They made a big deal about mm-hmm. that all of his movies came to Netflix, and they did, and then this one was removed. I don't know why, but you can see the rest of them, Real Life, Modern Romance, Lost in America, Mother. You can see them all, the Muse. I think the Muse is on there. You can see them all on Netflix. This one you would have to go rent on iTunes, but it's or maybe just wait till Netflix gets it again. It's completely worth it. It's a really delightful movie with a lot on its mind, but very, very funny and great comedic performances. I mean, Buck Henry just in his one scene is so damn funny. I mean, right. I love Buck Henry, but man, I mean, everybody is great, and Brooks and Streep are a great pair. Apparently, this movie really did not do well at the box office. It's gone on to become kind of a cult thing, which is great. But at the time, it was a bomb. And apparently, I had read, you know, who knows whether this stuff is true or not, but I had read that Meryl Streep was absolutely, like, apoplectic because she was so happy with this movie and thought it was great. And it just sank like a stone when it came out. And she was apparently not terribly pleased about that. And Warner Brothers maybe didn't do the job she was hoping they would do. But over time, people have come to love it. And it's a movie that a lot of people know about that, you know, Albert Brooks's movies never make money. But I think over time they become people, you know, they grow in estimation, and this one is absolutely deserve it. So yeah, this is just a terrific movie. And so Max, thank you for coming on to talk about this. I wanted to talk about Albert Brooks so much on this show, and I've never had the chance. So I really appreciate it. This was so much fun.
Oh no, thanks for having me. I love this movie, and as you were mentioning, you know, it is also extremely rewatchable.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times I've seen this movie, to be honest, but I never get tired of it. And, you know, and I love Albert Brooks in general. So yeah, being able to talk about this movie has been great.
All right. Excellent. So where can people find you on the internet if they want to hear more from you?
The best place to find me is at greatcaesarspost.com, or actually probably even better than that is itsplasticman.wordpress.com. And I can be found at either of those on Facebook and Twitter.
Terrific. I love It's Plastic Man. And of course, we will be doing part two of our Aquaman, Plastic Man, and Adventure Comics thing at some point. I'm bad at doing part twos on Fire and Water. I've started lots of part ones and I've never finished it. But we will get to do part two, absolutely, because that was a lot of fun. So, yeah, go follow Max over on those two sites. It's Plastic Man. We'll have those links in the show notes. Of course, if you want to follow this show, it's over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. And this and all of our other great shows can be found at our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, Max, thanks so much for coming on. I always enjoy talking to you. And until next week, that's a wrap.
What is this?
It's my hotel.
This is your hotel?
Yeah. Where are you staying?
Obviously, the place for people who weren't very generous and didn't adopt anybody. I'm at the Continental. Come over one day. We'll paint it. Listen, tomorrow after the trials, you want to have dinner?
Oh, I can't tomorrow.
You can't?
No, I'm sorry.
Well, you can't have plans here already. What am I supposed to do, call you in 2 weeks?
Well, no, Sam is just having a small dinner party. He said that there are going to be some very, very smart people there. And he asked me if I wanted to go.
Sam again. I hope you're not dating your defender. I just know in my heart it's wrong.
Well, I'll call you after the dinner.
Okay.
We can talk on the phone.
Good. It'll give me time to have sex with my prosecutor.
Good luck tomorrow.
Thanks.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Champagne and caviar now being served in the blue room.